Hallo, bei den philosophischen Brocken sagt Günter Friesinger heute mit einer Sendung zum Thema freie Software und Hacker. Wir hören dazu einen Vortrag, den Richard Stallman im Juli auf der Hope No. 6 in New York gehalten hat. Der Vortrag behandelt die Themen freie Software, Hackerethik und die Frage, was überhaupt Freiheit ist.
So I'm going to talk about free software and the hacker community. First of all, I'd better explain what free software means, since probably even a lot of you have not heard what it means. Free software means software that respects the user's freedom. There are four essential freedoms for the user of software, freedoms that every software user should always have. And these four freedoms make the definition of free software. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish for any purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it so that the program does what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others, including publication. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community, and that's the freedom to distribute your modified versions, including publication, when you wish. None of these is an obligation. You're never required to do any of these things, but the point is you're free to do them if you wish. And that means the software respects your freedom and respects the social solidarity of your community. If you use a program that doesn't give you freedom number two, you're in danger of falling into a moral dilemma at any moment when your friend says, "Could I have a copy of that program?" At that moment, you will be forced to choose between two evils. One evil is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. The other evil is to deny your friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. Now, once you're in the dilemma, you should choose the lesser evil, which is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. This is the lesser evil because it's directed at somebody who has done wrong. We can suppose that your friend is a good friend, a helpful person, and ordinarily would deserve your cooperation. Whereas the developer of a proprietary program has deliberately attacked the social solidarity of your community. Now, that's wrong. So if you can't help doing wrong to somebody, better it should be a wrongdoer that you do it to. However, to be the lesser evil does not mean it's good. It's never good to make an agreement and not keep it. Now, it may be less bad than keeping the agreement, depending on what you agreed to do. But it's never good. And an unauthorized copy of a non-free program shares most of the ethical ills of an authorized copy. The only one it doesn't share is that of rewarding the perpetrator. What you should really do once you have understood this dilemma is make sure you're never in it. Don't set foot on the path that's going to lead you someday to that dilemma. And there are two ways to avoid it. One is don't have any friends. That's the method suggested by the proprietary software developers. And the other method is don't use proprietary software. That's the method I prefer. That way, I don't have to worry about a moral dilemma if someone asks for a copy of a program I've got on my computer, because I will only accept free software onto it. If someone offers me an attractive, convenient program on the condition that I promise not to share it with you, I will say no, because that's the right thing to do. And I would rather forego the convenience and fun of that program than put myself in a situation where I'd be ashamed of what I had done. Just being free to share does not mean that you're in control of your own computer. For that, you need freedom number one. You need to be able to study the program and change it. That's what enables you to decide what your computer does. If you use a program that doesn't give you freedom number one, the freedom to study the source code and change it, then the developer controls what you can do. And you are under the developer's power. This is unjust. This is an unjust system of subjugation. If you don't have freedom number one, you can't even tell for certain what the program does. Lots of proprietary programs have malicious features. Because once a developer is in a position of power, the developer faces the temptation to go one step further and start using that power specifically to mistreat others. So they put in spy features and features designed to restrict the user and even back doors. Now, spyware is quite common. One proprietary program that you might have heard of that spies on the user is called Windows XP. When the user of Windows XP, and I won't say you because I'm sure you wouldn't use a program like this, when the user of Windows XP searches her own files for a word, it sends a message saying what word was searched for. That's one spy feature. But there's another that we know of. When Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it sends Microsoft a list of all the software installed on the machine. Now, these spy features were not announced by Microsoft. People had to discover them through investigation, which was not always easy. There may be others which we don't know about. But spying is not limited to Windows. Windows Media Player also spies on the user. It reports everything the user looks at. Total surveillance. But please don't think that this is something that only Microsoft, the great Satan, would do. Because, in fact, RealPlayer was the first such program to do this kind of spying. Total surveillance, reporting everything the user looks at. And all Microsoft did was imitate them. Lots of companies spy on the user, and interestingly, the TiVo spies on the user in the same way, reporting everything the user looks at. Now, this is particularly interesting because the TiVo uses a lot of free software. It has a small GNU plus Linux operating system in it. And when it was first released, a lot of people in our community applauded it for using free software. But it also contains non-free software, and it has malicious features like spying on the user and digital restrictions management. And this shows that to use free software, which implicitly means to use some free software some of the time, is not a sufficient target. The target has to be to use only software that respects your freedom so that you have full freedom. Anything less is insufficient. And the TiVo is also an example of another malicious practice that I'll talk about later. But malicious features go beyond spying on the user. There's also the functionality of refusing to function, where the program says, I don't want to show you this file. I don't want to let you copy part of this file. I'm not going to print this file for you because I don't like you enough. This is DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, or Digital Handcuffs, where the program is designed specifically to restrict you for the sake of someone else. It becomes a simple instrument of someone else's power over you. And then there are back doors. There was a proprietary program called Interbase, which was liberated, and then the users could see that it contained a back door, and they could fix it. Presumably it had the same back door when it was proprietary, but the users couldn't see it or fix it. Another proprietary program that has a back door that you may have heard of is called Windows XP. You see, when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, Microsoft can identify the user. which means that they can deliver that user an upgrade designed specifically for him. They can take total control of that person's machine in any way they want, and that user has very little recourse. So we know about this backdoor because we can deduce it from known facts, but there might be others. Microsoft was caught in 1999 having put a backdoor in a piece of server software for the NSA. And there might be backdoors introduced by others that Microsoft doesn't know about. For instance, some programmers in India working on the development of Windows XP were arrested and accused of working for Al-Qaeda, trying to introduce another backdoor that Microsoft wasn't supposed to know about. Well, apparently that attempt failed. Was there another attempt that succeeded? We can't tell. Now, there are various kinds of malicious features that proprietary software developers can put in, but not all of them do so. Some do and some don't. Of course, you can't necessarily tell which is which. So the result is that all proprietary software is just trust me software, where you surrender to a blind faith in a developer which you know might not deserve it. But what of the ones that don't put in malicious features? Well, they may be honest, but they're still human, so they make mistakes. And that means that their code has bugs. And the user of a program without freedom number one, the freedom to study and change the source code, is just as helpless confronting an unintended error in the code as she is confronting a deliberate misfeature. The user of a non-free program is a prisoner of his software. Now, we, the developers of free software, are also human, so our code has errors too. Every non-trivial program has bugs. The difference is that we respect your freedom. So when you find errors in our code, you can fix them. Make ourselves perfect. We can treat you decently. But freedom one is not enough. Freedom one is the freedom to personally study and change the source code to make it do what you want. this is not enough because millions of computer users don't know how to program, so they can't directly exercise Freedom One. But even for programmers like me, Freedom One's not enough because there's just too much software. In fact, there's just too much free software. Nobody can possibly study the source code of all the programs that she uses and master them all and personally make all the changes that she might want. The only way we can fully take control of our software is to do it working together, cooperating. And for this, we need Freedom 3, which is the freedom to publish or distribute your modified versions. With this freedom, when a few people make a change, everyone else can adopt it if they like it. And as a result, those millions of non-programmers get the benefit of what the programmers do. If there are a million users of a free program that want a certain change, by chance we'd expect a few thousand to know how to program. And someday a few of them will make that change and release their modified version, and all the million can get the benefit of it. So freedoms 0 and 2, to run the program and copy the program and distribute it, those every user can do. Those don't require knowing how to program. Freedoms 1 and 3 involve programming, so you can only exercise them to the extent you know how to program. But as people do that, everyone else gets the benefit as well. So these four freedoms are essential to everyone, and the result of these four freedoms is that the software develops democratically under the control of the users. Proprietary software develops under the control of its developer and gives that developer power over the users. Free software makes the users free and enables them to control their own lives, and that's what freedom means. So I reached these conclusions in 1983, which is why I launched the free software movement and began developing the GNU operating system, GNU's not Unix, for the specific purpose of making it possible to use computers in freedom. Most of the users, and there may be around 100 million of them, of the GNU system don't know it's the GNU system. In 1992, when the GNU system was almost finished, the main missing component was the kernel. And at that point, a kernel named Linux filled that gap. So what people use, including me, is actually the combination of the GNU system with Linux as the kernel, the GNU plus Linux system. But most people are misinformed and think that the whole system is Linux and don't realize that we developed it. That's unfortunate, because in addition to forgetting the role of the members of the GNU project, hundreds and thousands of us, they forget in the development of the system, which they think is Linux, they also forget the role of the ideals of freedom and social solidarity, which were the motivations for doing this work. Other operating systems were developed for technical motives or commercial motives. This one was developed for the sake of freedom and social solidarity. And when people forget that, it's dangerous. Because if people don't value their freedom, they will lose it. History, including the recent history of our country, shows this clearly. When people don't value their freedom, they won't defend it. But in order to value their freedom, they have to know about it. And in the field of computing, because it's so new, we haven't had much time to teach people. We haven't had much time to discover what the appropriate human rights are. Well, I think I've identified four of them, the four fundamental freedoms that define free software. Are four human rights that every user of computers must have. But how are we going to teach people about this when the system that we develop for these reasons is confused with Linux, and everyone knows that the developer of Linux doesn't believe in these freedoms, that he supports, quote, open source, unquote, and that he developed Linux just to have fun. Well, I've got nothing against having fun. I expect that almost every free software developer is having fun doing it. And they should have fun. What could be more fun than programming? If we don't know how to be serious as well, if we don't recognize serious goals that are so important that they're worth sacrificing some of your fun, goals like freedom and democracy, then what's going to happen? Well, Bush has already showed us what's going to happen. We used to admire the people who sacrificed their lives so we could have freedom. And now we're invited to sacrifice our freedom to protect us from small, unlikely dangers to our lives. And I think that's stupid and backwards and insults the people who fought to get us freedom in the first place. So how did I reach these ideas? What led me to conclude in 1983 that software should be free, that proprietary software is unethical and antisocial, that it was a social problem, and that we had to solve this problem by getting rid of it? It all goes back to the hacker community. In the 1970s, I participated in the hacker community, a community of programmers who were in the habit normally of sharing their work with everybody, anyone who was interested, because that was our way of life, because we were programming for the joy. Yes, we were having fun, but having fun led us to a way of life and a way of thinking about our way of life. Having fun put together with the political ideals that were taught to us by the United States of America and then conspicuously disregarded by the United States of America in the war in Vietnam. When I joined this community, we called ourselves hackers. And what that meant was that we were programming with joy, with gusto, with enthusiasm, and that was what it was all about. We were using our intelligence in a playful way, sometimes just for fun, sometimes doing useful jobs that needed to be done, but either way, we could still enjoy using our intelligence in a playful way. And that's what hacker meant, and that's what it still means. When I joined this community, it was during the Vietnam War. I had nightmares, well, sort of like nightmares, except they weren't asleep. What do you call them? Horrible negative fantasies of being drafted and being destroyed because I refused to call officers sir. I had learned to love freedom, and what I saw in front of me was the perfect enemy of freedom, drafting people to fight to keep one dictatorship in power instead of another, and doing so based on lies. We now know that the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was the excuse for sending U.S. troops to fight in Vietnam, was a fabrication. It was a pure lie. Of course, just about all of us despised the U.S. government's policies at the time. This was not unusual. What was unusual was that we had a kind of free society. In the artificial intelligence lab, everyone was welcome to come and use the computer, and the reason was the hackers were in charge. At every other computer facility, there were administrators in charge, and they made sure to have control over what anybody could do. The hackers, before I got there, made sure that that couldn't happen by declining to implement security in the computer system. They realized that by implementing passwords, they would simply hand administrators tools to control everyone. We recognized that a computer with security was like a totalitarian police state where everything not explicitly that everything you couldn't justify was forbidden. By default, everything's forbidden, except a little space where you're allowed to do things. And anything, and take a look at their policies, anything that might enable you to throw off their control is forbidden. Because maintaining themselves in control is always the first priority. So once you start following up this analogy, you'll see a lot of similarities. So back in the 70s, we didn't have to fight to defend our practice of sharing software. We just did it. We always did it. People shared software with us and we used it. We wrote software and sometimes other people wanted it and we shared it with them and they used it. That was simply our way of life. We appreciated it, but we didn't have to fight for it. We just went on living it. What we had to fight was pressure to have security. It was in 1976 or so that everyone else said, the net is too big, you can't have a computer without security now, and we just kept on doing it. People would log in, they'd heard that there was a command you could give to set the system to shut down. So they would type the command and it would work. It would say system shutdown scheduled in N minutes, and then someone else would cancel it. Well, the other users didn't want it to go down, so they canceled it. But the point is, there was no security stopping anybody in the world from logging in on our machine and doing this. But the users were there, and when the shutdown wasn't supposed to happen, they canceled it. If there was a shutdown for a good reason, like system maintenance, then the users understood and they didn't cancel it. And sometimes people said, what if somebody inserts a bug into your code? And I said, well, they can't possibly insert as many as I do. So I guess I'll just fix that bug like I fixed the other ones.